Good afternoon. I hope everyone's having a good weekend, and welcome to On the Docket. I'm Patricia Salkin, Dean of Touro Law Center in Central Islip, and every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today, on the docket, we're talking about taxes. Some of you may have filed already, while I'm guessing most of you are still gathering documents, like me. According to ABC News, 80.5 million people have filed as of March 22nd. That's 4 million less than last year. In just a few minutes, we'll talk to three experts in the tax field from the Long Island tax firm of Baker Tilly, Virchow, and Kraus. But first, let's talk with Dan Sobotnick, Touro Law Center professor, tax expert, CPA, and former investment banker. Dan also advises the Touro Law Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, known as VITA, where students provide free tax help to low and moderate income community members. The project is sponsored by the United States Internal Revenue Service and overseen by Bethpage Federal Credit Union. More than 25 law student volunteers have been trained and can file tax returns directly from the law school, a designated site for the program. This is the fifth year that Touro Law students have participated in the project. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dan, can you explain more about the volunteer program, how it actually works?
Sure. In the fall semester every year, we go to our tax students and we give them an opportunity to volunteer to sign up for this program. The program offers training to our students in filing tax returns and gathering data and filing tax returns. Gives them client interaction, lets them see an entire tax return that is prepared, helps pull together the entire tax course for them in so doing, because obviously when you're teaching tax, you're doing it piecemeal. This pulls it all together, and there's the sense of satisfaction that comes out of doing a tax return, overcoming fear of doing tax returns in the future. I'm delighted. I actually, if you want to hear the story, Dean,
sure.
Many years ago, there were students would come out of my class, and they come out of 99% of the classes in law school never having done a tax return. And I got a call, this must have been 25 years ago, from a mother of a tax student saying, Professor, my child was in your tax class and doesn't know how to do a tax return. How can that be? Well, I was humiliated at the time, and so ever since then, I've required students to prepare tax returns, and this is the kind of, you know, one of the results. They do a tax return for me, and those who continue work for the IRS and do their own programs.
So that's terrific, because it's a great service learning project.
Yes.
And yeah, one thing you said is it helps people overcome the fear of doing a tax return. Why is it that Americans fear something that we're required to do?
I think, and I've heard this so many times that it's a cliche, I didn't go to law school to do math. And I'm sure you've heard that too. And so you throw a couple of numbers on the table, and no matter how many times you tell them, it's just adding and subtracting, and every once in a while multiplying, but not too often.
But it's not just the law students, it's
out.
The average Americans
no, it's the
that
average,
don't want
no, no,
to fill
no,
out
but,
their...
but you know, one would expect more from law students. And there clearly is this divide in the culture between the number crunchers and the non-number crunchers, and
right.
it's an extreme reaction, and it's, you know, it's unfortunate. But students get over it.
So who qualifies for the VITA program?
My recollection is that the income limit is $52,000 for an individual or family.
Okay.
So there are many people who qualify and many people who do not qualify.
And do you see trends in particular problems or repeat issues that come up when people come in to have the VITA students do their tax returns?
Well,
are they complex?
You know, oftentimes individuals, particularly low-income individuals who are totally bewildered by the tax return, maybe they've never done any before, don't even know what documents to bring to the office. You have to go back and bring the documents back and again until finally you get the documents that you need. Mm. And then there's the tax law itself that is complex. Many individuals don't know there's such a thing as an earned income tax credit. It has had a profound effect on this country.
What is it? What is the earned income tax credit?
It's a credit that the government offers for those whose income levels are below a certain number, particularly if they have minor children. I mean, you can get some income tax credit without having minor children, but the greatest beneficiaries, the greatest number of beneficiaries, are those with minor children. And, you know, it's counterintuitive. You know, why should the government give me money when I'm working at a job? But this was enacted into law quite a number of years ago, and it has helped, according to most accounts, it has helped people stay on the job.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of talk at the federal government about paperwork reduction and simplification, but in the tax area, it just seems like the tax laws are so complex. Why is that?
Most people, I think, would answer that the tax law is a function of the lobbying efforts of 100 million Americans over the years. And that's certainly true to an extent. Lots of provisions in there relate to one or a very few number of taxpayers, and they're below the radar screen. And they're not picked up, and they go on forever, and it's impossible to pull them out. But the other thing, and I tell my students this, and they're always stunned when I say this, the computer itself allows for the system that we have. If individuals had to, and I'm not even talking about individuals with robust economic mm-hmm. lives, if individuals had to do their tax returns by hand, there'd be a revolution in the country. It cannot be done. Something close to 90% of taxpayers now, this was not true when I was going to school mm-hmm. or when I was, you know, new on the job. This was not true at all. Many people did it by hand, but now you can't do it by hand. And it's the computer itself that has made that possible, because you don't have to make the calculations. Mm-hmm. The calculations are all done for you.
And so if the calculations are done for you by the computer, what's the role of the tax lawyer in all of this? You know, you can buy TurboTax online. You have storefronts in strip malls that offer tax preparation. You know, what really is the role of the lawyer in this, and why is it important to check in periodically?
Many times, something new happens to the taxpayer. The taxpayer does a tax return and has an advisor and thinks he or she has things under control, and then something happens. There's an inheritance, there are medical expenses, there are casualty losses, and they forget that, or never knew in the first place, that these things affect one's tax return. The earned income tax credit, as I said before, is something that is not intuitive. So change is something that ought to trigger some mostly financial change, ought to trigger the thinking on the part of the taxpayer that maybe he or she needs to consult an expert. It doesn't have to be a lawyer. There are plenty of accountants who do this. In fact, accountants mostly do this.
So that's change in an individual or family's status, but there's also lots of changes that Congress is thinking about. And what are some of those things right now on the horizon?
Well, this is not a comfortable setting for, let us say, the tabloids. And I say that because I've followed developments and proposals and changes for 30 years. And every time anybody gets excited, the effort peters out. And we get very little change. There are things on the table now, and there are even some things that people agree on. But I just want to alert the listener that they should not expect radical change. For example, there's a new proposal that came out a couple of days ago to increase the standard deduction from about $6,000 to $11,000 in an effort to preclude the need for keeping records. If you give every individual $11,000, family gets $22,000. The idea is nobody will have to worry about receipts. So that's on the table. It's not only that we've been talking generally about change, we've been talking about simplification. This would simplify. On the other hand, what are the implications of simplification? The change that I'm referring to carries with it is elimination of the deduction for some home mortgage interest and all state and local tax expenses. That's a very big deal in states like New York. And so we would not be getting the benefit in New York because of the standard deduction, the increased standard deduction. We wouldn't get the benefit from those expenses. And that would have a profound change. It would have a profound change not only economically, it would have a profound change politically if we felt we were not getting a deduction directly for that.
So it's important for the average person to also pay attention to what Congress is talking about, what the president is talking about. Because at the end of the day, we still need a certain amount of money to fund the federal government. So exactly who's paying more and who's paying less results from these proposed changes in the tax law. I want to thank you, Dan, for being with us today. And please stay with us because coming up, we'll talk to Arnold Haskell, Tim Mulcahy, and Adam Rosenfeld, all tax experts from Baker, Tilly, Virchow, and Krauss. Stay with us. You're listening to On the Docket with Toro Law Dean Patricia Salkin on 103.9 Long Island News Radio. Welcome back to On the Docket. This is Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center, and today we're talking taxes. We're thrilled to have tax experts Arnold Haskell, Tim Mulcahy, and Adam Rosenfeld with us from Baker, Tilly, Virchow, and Krauss. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi.
Good afternoon. Well, good morning. I don't know what it is.
Let's start with you, Arnold. You're a tax partner at Baker Tilly with 30 years of experience in public accounting, and you were once an IRS field agent. How long do people have to keep their tax records and receipts?
I think in order to really clarify that, we really have to talk about the statute of limitations. And generally speaking, the normal statute of limitations is 3 years from the date from the due date of the return if you file prior to April 15th, or 3 years from the date of filing. However, if there's substantial omissions of income, which means more than 25% of gross income, that statute is extended for 6 years. And if it's a fraudulently filed tax return, that statute is extended. There never is a statute. The statute doesn't run on fraud. So although federal law really says that you need to keep your records for 3 years, in most cases it's safer to keep them for in excess of 3 years. Certain things you can keep for 3 years, certain things it's recommended to keep for 6 years, and certain records it's recommended to keep forever.
So clients of your firm, would you hold on to the records for them, or are they obligated to hold on to their own records?
Actually, within the firm, we have a policy in which files are destroyed after 7 years.
Okay.
And that's a firm policy for various reasons.
So what should someone do if they get that fateful letter in the mail that they're being audited?
Call your CPA, of course.
After the panic.
Yeah, well, that was the first thing I was going to say. Don't panic. They're really not as bad as most people perceive them to be. But certainly the first thing you should do is we've found that you shouldn't be the one to contact the IRS. You should have your tax preparer, CPA, attorney, whoever it may be the one to contact the CPA, the Internal Revenue Service, and deal with them. It's very important from my perspective to always have a buffer between the Internal Revenue Service or New York State Department of Taxation and the taxpayer. I can tell them that I don't know something and I'll get back to you. It's very difficult for a taxpayer to do that. Taxpayers are flustered. They try to ask leading questions. So I would clearly not recommend that the taxpayer be the one to represent themselves.
All right. So if you want the right to remain silent, you should have somebody representing
you. Yeah. It doesn't give you the right to remain silent. There may be times where the Internal Revenue Service would like to interview you, but generally speaking, it does work that way.
It's usually less intimidating to have somebody with you.
Clearly less intimidating. It's normal for a power of attorney to be provided and a representative handle the entire audit, and the taxpayer never see the Internal Revenue Service agent. Right. But I've always found that, and maybe some people don't agree with this, I've always found to be cooperative with them. Don't antagonize them. Provide them the information they ask for in a timely manner, mm-hmm. And you usually have a better result.
Great. So what kind of free tax advice or information can you provide to our listeners in terms of some changes that are in effect now regarding deductions and exemptions?
Well, one of the things that came to mind, and it's a provision that came back this year after it had gone away for a few years, and that dealt with the phase-out of itemized deductions in general and the phase-out of exemptions when income levels exceeded a certain amount. Those amounts we're not going to go into, but they're $300,000 for married filing jointly, $250,000 essentially for others. And the exemptions phase out at $425,000 of total adjusted gross income. So after that point, you lose your dependency exemption. And one of the things going back before when it was still around was dealing with the educational credits. And generally speaking, or in most cases, someone who has significant or fairly high income, let's even call it $400,000, will never get the benefit if their child is going to college of any of the educational credits. However, if the child also works and pays his own tax, let's say they make $20,000 a year doing a side job or something such as that, it is possible it's allowable for the parent to give up their dependency exemption. The child can't claim the dependency exemption, but the child can claim the educational credit against their own tax. When the phase out of the exemption was in play, the parent got no benefit from it when their income was over a certain amount. So it was worthwhile to relinquish the child's exemption. When for the last couple of years that was no longer available, the benefit to the parent of the exemption was so great that it didn't pay to do it. And now we're back to the phase out of the exemptions. So people, if they have children who work or children who go to college, should be looking at whether or not that child can use the educational credits versus the parent.
That's a good tip. I may come back to you before we end the show, but I want to get to Tim Mulcahy, also of Baker Tilly. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
So the 3.8 net investment income tax became effective in 2013, and it's an additional 3.8% tax on what's referred to as the net investment income. At what income levels does this additional tax apply?
Well, for married filing joint, it's $250,000. For married filing separate, $125,000, and for all others, $200,000. I think there's a big surprise that a lot of people are going to see in the next month, and that's between this 3.8 and the overall top rate going from 35 to 39.6 and the phase out of the deductions that Arnie talked about. For some people, you know, it's getting close to a 10% increase.
That's pretty significant. So on the 3.8 net investment income tax, what types of income are subject to the tax? For example, does it apply to income from all forms of rental real estate?
Well, it applies to capital gains, dividends, annuities, royalties, interest, rents from real estate, and income from any kind of passive activity, which is an activity where maybe you own a piece of a company, but you're not active in the company.
And are there any exceptions to the general rules that have been set in place?
Well, there are some exceptions, and the rule is the whole area is more complex than we could actually talk about in this show. But there's something called a real estate professional where somebody is continuously involved in the rental business, and they are participating more than 500 hours a year, and that is then treated as though it's non-passive, and so it's not taxed. Hmm. If you have rental property where, let's say, you have a manufacturing business and you also own the building, and you're renting the building essentially to yourself, the self-rental income is not taxed. And if you had sold rental property previously and you're collecting the payments under the installment method, and those payments are taxed in the current year, that wouldn't be taxed either.
Great, thanks. Tim, we may come back to you as well, but I want to talk to Adam Rosenfeld, who's also with us from Baker Tilly, because Adam's specialty is healthcare. This year is going to be a little complicated because of the Affordable Care Act, and folks in small businesses really need to be aware of this. So, Adam, if I offer insurance to my employees but they don't take it, will I still be penalized under the healthcare reform?
Well, the short answer is maybe, but since it's a 3,000-page law with 20,000-plus pages of regulation, there are no short answers. So actually, I'll answer the question as if the law was fully in place, because it's as recent as the last couple of weeks, they've been changing the regulations on the penalties, the pay or play, as they're called. So to answer the question, I'm going to assume the law is fully in effect, the penalty phase. Mm-hmm. So if you're a business that's subject to the penalty, meaning a 50-plus business, 50-plus employees with full-time or full-time equivalent employees, the only way to assure that you're not going to get a penalty is to do two things: offer coverage that meets minimum value and make it affordable. So minimum value means a bronze level plan. Bronze, mm-hmm. silver, gold, and platinum are the new plans. It's 60% actuarial value. Any plan available, fully insured, that you buy on the market in New York State is that's bronze is going to meet that value. But affordability is the key. And affordability, there's a lot of definitions of it, and actually it changed several times in the law. They came out with three safe harbors. The one that most of my clients are using and most people are using is using the making sure that the cost for single coverage does not exceed 9.5% of W-2 wages, regardless of whether or not the employee actually takes single or family coverage. We're measuring the cost of single coverage against 9.5% of their Box 1 W-2 wages. Now, it should be noted there that it doesn't matter what you charge the families. So as an employer, yesterday, if you were paying 50% of all costs, you want your plan to be deemed affordable, so you're not subject to these penalties, you might want to shift some of those monies from family to single so that the single cost doesn't cost more than 9.5% of your wages.
Well, clearly the Affordable Care Act is having impacts on businesses and on individuals throughout the state and throughout the country, and I hope that you'll come back on a future show on the docket where we focus specifically on the Affordable Care Act and talk about some of the tax implications for businesses. But that's all the time we have today. Adam, Tim, Arnold, Dan, I want to thank you for joining us. And don't forget that On the Docket airs every Sunday at 4:30 on Long Island News 103.9.